This past Tuesday, we spoke with filmmaker Josh Fox and Sioux activist Dallas Goldtooth about the protests at Standing Rock, North Dakota. For a bonus weekend podcast, we've decided to look back at some other segments about what's happening on the front lines of environmental protection and political activism. In 2013, Mark Weiss discussed his documentary, A Fierce Green Fire, along with one of the film's subjects, Lois Gibbs, who not only led the protests at Love Canal, but started the Center for Health, Environment, and Justice. In 2014, we interviewed Francis Beinecke, former head of the Natural Resources Defense Council. And to bring it closer to home, last year we were joined by Joseph Alexio, who wrote about one of the most important waterways in the history of New York Harbor. It's since been turned into an industrial dumping ground, the Gowanus Canal. Enjoy!
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Environmental activists warn that there is no planet B we can go to if we don't stop destroying the one we live on. A new documentary called A Fierce Green Fire, The Battle for a Living Planet, investigates the environmental movement and the role of global activism over the last 50 years. It's directed and written by Mark Kitchell, the Academy Award-nominated director of Berkeley in the 60s, and narrated by Robert Redford, Ashley Judd, Van Jones, Isabel Allende, and Meryl Streep. It premiered at Sundance Film Festival in 2012 and opens tomorrow at New York's Cinema Village. And I'm very pleased to welcome its executive producer, Mark Weiss, along with environmental activist Lois Gibbs, who's featured in the film for the key role she played in the cleanup of the Love Canal. Welcome to our show.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
Now, Mark, the film is named after the book A Fierce Green Fire, The American Environmental Movement by Philip Shabakov. Did you and your director just read the book and say, hey, we got to make a movie about that?
Well, the book was definitely an inspiration for the film, although the film is a departure from the way in which the story is told in the book. Obviously, a book can be very comprehensive and very detailed. The film needs to choose a very small number of stories and tell them really well.
And you focus on five main stories in this film, including halting the development of dams in the Grand Canyon, Greenpeace's campaign to save whales and baby harp seals, the preservation of the Amazon forest, and the issue of climate change. But as you suggest, there are many more horror stories you could have told. So did you focus on these because they're emblematic?
Actually, what I love about the film is that the first four of the five stories are really dramatic tellings of environmental activists coming up against what seemed in the moment as insurmountable. They were almost impossible to win when they started, and yet in each case they did win. In each case they really did prevail in a significant way, and that kind of sets the table for the fifth section, which is about the challenge of climate change and what are we going to do about it.
It did help that you had some very nice footage.
The footage is extraordinary. The footage is very dramatic, and especially in more recent years, Mark had the great fortune of having a lot of other films that had been made over the years, and he was able to get the material from that. But really, for me, the strength of it is the storytelling.
And Lois, Mark mentioned that some of these situation seemed almost insurmountable. That is definitely true in your case. Had you been involved in environmental activism before the Love Canal case?
No, actually, I was not. I was a stay-at-home mom with two adorable children minding my own business, and Love Canal sort of came to me and bubbling up in my basement. And it is true. I mean, I think that I agree with Mark. That's one of the strengths of this film. Because, you know, I now work with communities all across the country who are facing lots of different types of things, insurmountable. I mean, just incredible challenges. And the strength of this film, whether it's the whales, whether it's the Amazon, whether it's Love Canal, is that ordinary people, and it's shown in, like, real film, so it's not like a make-believe story, ordinary people just stand up and say, I'm going to take this on. And, you know, there's just huge challenges in front of them. They're a very long journey like mine, but They're able to overcome such huge obstacles. It's just amazing to just watch this film and see what people have done. It certainly encouraged me to go out and keep doing this work after 35 years.
How did you discover that Hooker Chemical Company had dumped 20,000 tons of toxic waste into the canal?
Well, it actually was a journalist, much like you, although it was a newspaper journalist, who had done these series of articles in our local newspaper that said there was this Love Canal, this dump site, 20,000 tons, and it went on to talk about the diseases and the different problems related to the chemicals, which we didn't know a whole lot about 35 years ago compared to what do we know today. And I just read these articles and said, oh, my goodness. That's us. That's me. That's my children. Both of my children were sick at Love Canal. And, you know, I had historically just tried to figure out, like, what was going on and why were they so sick. And you know, with these articles just, you know, made it all come together. It filled in all the blanks. And it was right the 99th Street Elementary School that my son attended kindergarten in. It was right there. I mean, the playground was over 20,000 tons of chemical. How could someone do that?
And there were a disproportionate number of birth defects of children born in the area, high rates of cancer and all sorts of other problems. And nobody had thought to wonder why until you learned about what had happened with this toxic waste?
Well, it was interesting because we did. We had 56% of our children born with birth defects at Love Canal. There was a number of studies that documented that. But the thing was that neighbors really didn't talk to neighbors and collect all that information until after we found out about Love Canal. And then we began connecting the dots, and it's like, This is the problem. But, you know, when you talk to your neighbor, you may know your neighbor's child is sick or they had a child with a minor or major birth defect or something. But you never, in a neighborhood like this, really put all of these things together until you're really saying, wait a minute, there's a flag here. We need to figure out what this flag means. And that's why we went out and did the study. And it had some pretty frightening information.
The film gives the impression that it was the housewives of the neighborhood who played the most significant role in the fight against Hooker Chemical Company and demands for relocation out of Love Canal from the government. Were the men also involved in the battle, or was this mostly a battle that women conducted?
Well, actually, men were involved, but one of the problems at Love Canal was that 80% of the community's men worked in the chemical industry. So imagine you're sending your husband out to the chemical industry to go to work every day, which puts bread on the table and a roof over your head. So and then the women did the organizing because the men couldn't really do it, and they didn't feel comfortable doing it because they were fearful of losing their jobs or fearful of some type of retaliation. But for the most part, the men were very supportive. They just, you know, when you hear a jobs environment, we hear that a lot today even, it was really clear to us that the workers felt a little pressure from the industry, but that wasn't going to stop them from supporting the women and the other efforts at Love Canal to move this issue forward.
Was Hooker Chemical ever penalized for dumping toxic waste into the Love Canal?
Actually, they were, but it took a long time. It had to actually go through the court system, and New York Supreme Court did find them guilty and responsible for negligence. And as a result, Hooker Chemical, which is now owned by Occidental Petroleum ended up paying $197 million for Love Canal, and that was for the cleanup, for the relocation of families, for containing the waste, and for perpetual monitoring of the community from the day people moved out. So,
well, have you followed other families from Love Canal? Are there still residual health effects from the exposure to that toxic waste?
There is. We do follow them. We visit at least quarterly with some of the residents at Love Canal. We have a last dollar fund in which we find out about medical problems, because if the residents pay out of their pocket, this came from a lawsuit, we will cover that out-of-pocket cost. And what is interesting is that some of the acute problems went away, like the asthma and the skin rashes and things like that. But the cancers are there, the other diseases are there, but more importantly, what they're finding is the Love Canal children, so these would be my children, for example, the Love Canal children are having children with birth defect rates at the same level we did. So we're talking about over 50% of the Love Canal children's children are having birth defects, and that both the Love Canal families and the children's children, sounds complicated, but are having more girl babies than boy babies. And what that essentially indicates or is symptomatic of is that endocrine-disrupting chemicals have affected the system of our families and our children because, you know, these are all the things that we're finding in the new science. And that's really frightening because we're talking about my generation, my children's generation, and their children. So when you talk about these problems, whether it's Love Canal or the fracking that's going on in New York, or they want to have go on in New York, hopefully we'll continue to stop that. These chemicals are not about the immediate problem that you can clean it up, fix it up, move the people, or clean the air, and everything is okay. It is not okay. People are sick for generations and generations. It is not okay. It does not go away. And that's the seriousness of these environmental health issues that we face in this nation.
My guests are Lois Gibbs, who was an activist in Love Canal, and later we'll get to some of the things that Lois did as an activist, some pretty controversial things. Also with us is Mark Weiss, who's the executive producer of a film called A Fierce Green Fire, The Battle for a Living Planet, which opens tomorrow at the Cinema Village at 22 East 12th Street. Mark, the film highlights some pretty controversial activists like David Brower, who was asked to leave the Sierra Club, and Paul Watson, who was forced out of Greenpeace. What did they do to be forced out of organizations that we generally consider to be pretty positive forces in our society?
Well, the stories are different, and the case of David Brower, of course, is that he was a very, very activist leader of the Sierra Club. It was an old organization founded in the late 1800s, and he came into leadership in the 60s and led it on an activist course, and I think he was moving too fast for the organization. It's interesting because I'm just recently joined the board of the Sierra Club Foundation, which is the nonprofit arm of the Sierra Club. And I was at a joint meeting last weekend and showed the first section of the film. Got just up to the point. It tells the story of Brower leading the club to victory, stopping the damming of the Grand Canyon. And then I turned it off right when it started talking about what happened next to David Brower, the fact that he was asked to leave. Mm-hmm. And everybody in the room said, well, we want to see this. I said, okay, that's why you need to see the whole film. But so in that case, you know, there was tension within the organization. In the case of Greenpeace, Greenpeace saw itself as being nonviolent. That was very much in its founding principles. Paul Watson didn't go with that.
And he was very confrontational.
He was much more confrontational and later started a new organization, which actually he bought a ship with funds that he raised and actually rammed whaling ships and sunk them on the open ocean.
Well, at a certain point, the film suggests for some people, activism turns into radicalism because people feel frustration. Right. And to some degree, that's what happened with you, Lois, isn't it? You wound up, I guess, frustrated with all the resistance you were facing from the Carter administration and the EPA, that you actually held two EPA representatives hostage for 5 hours.
Well, we actually detained them for their own safety, is how I prefer to say it. There were 600 angry people out in front of Love Canal. They told us that we had and our children had likely chromosome damage, which is another sort of multi-generational effect from Love Canal, and we were told we couldn't send our children to school in the air, we couldn't go in our basement, we couldn't go in our gardens, we couldn't walk outside. I mean, it was just all building, and EPA came out and told us about this chromosome damage, and it was just frightening. It was so frightening.
But the government seemed to resist doing much about it. Thinking back to Jimmy Carter, who seems to be somebody who would have perhaps been more open to your pleas, why do you think that happened? Was it simply a matter of not spending the money?
No, actually, it was way bigger than that. They didn't want to set a precedent. You know, Love Canal was really the first sort of organized public community. We weren't the first community fighting this battle, clearly, but we had the public's attention. And so they knew anything they did at Love Canal, they would have to do somewhere else. Well, according to their congressional research, they had potentially 50,000 other Love Canals across the country. So what they wanted to do in our neighborhood was minimize everything. They didn't want to spend the money. They didn't want to set those precedents that they might have to use at 50,000 other sites. And that's what why it caused us to do things like detaining those two gentlemen for 5 hours, because there was no other way to move them. We were sick. We were contaminated. There was evidence of both that you just couldn't deny. So it wasn't an issue of science. It was a political issue. Is the president going to do this? And if he sets a precedent, so be it. But is he going to protect the American people, not just at Love Canal, but at the other sites across the country? And so that holding the hostage really elevated it to national news, and the president had no choice because he was running for reelection. This was May, and he wanted to be reelected in November, and it didn't look good to poison the American voters. So,
but Mark, the next president, he lost that election to Ronald Reagan. Was Ronald Reagan more open to the sorts of things that the Love Canal people were asking for?
Well, of course, we know that Ronald Reagan was tremendously hostile to the environmental movement. There's a clip of him in the film in which he says, you know, they wanted to turn the White House into a bird's nest. You know, Lois is such an incredible example of someone who really found her voice in activism. And in some ways, that's one of the things that I think is a theme of the film is ordinary people, not anybody coming from any particular privileged background or anything, kind of rising to the occasion and saying there's a crisis that we need to respond to. And I'll just say one quick thing, which is that the stories are inspiring and kind of frame the last section, which is the challenge of climate change and the necessity for a movement of people active all around the country to take it on and to give it a sense of urgency.
So will that be the focus of Earth Day? The 43rd Earth Day will take place in a little over a month, April 22nd. Is that going to be the theme?
Actually, the theme of Earth Day this year is the face of climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm doing a project with the Earth Day Network, with the organization that has been doing Earth Day for 43 years, that will reach out to the young people in the country, to middle school, high school, and college age, to get them to raise their voice on the issue.
And Lois, you're the founder and executive director of the Center of Health, Environment, and Justice, which you launched in 1981. I suspect you're less concerned with climate change, although you mentioned fracking. You're more concerned still with the sorts of things that you had to deal with at Love Canal?
Well, I'm concerned with climate change as well as other issues, because they're all connected. You can't talk about, I mean, we work with people in mountaintop removal in West Virginia. We're working with people around coal-fired power plants. We're working with people in all of these in several places, including Syracuse, New York, and Oswego, around an Indian Point, around nuclear. I mean, all of these things are connected. They're really not a separate issue. Climate change is about energy. Energy and how we generate that energy really relates to communities where it's being generated, and how do we create energy in a way that is not poisoning people or destroying our environment, but instead giving those folks in West Virginia or in Oswego or Shell Bluff, Georgia, a job that is a healthy job, that's healthy for their community and healthy for the environment. So I really don't see a disconnect. I actually think this is kind of holistic, because everything that's affecting climate change, whether it's cars on the highway or whether it's, you know, the energy creation at the ground, involves community, and it, more importantly, it involves people standing up, like Mark said, and speaking out, really finding your voice, because, you know, we don't have that much time. I mean, it's we need to move quickly. We just can't keep going the way we are with blinders on. We really need to take this bull by the horn. And there's so many alternatives out there. That's the part that makes me crazy. It's like, it's not like we don't know how to do this. We just don't have the political will.
The film that we've been discussing is A Fierce Green Fire, The Battle for a Living Planet, written and directed by Mark Kitchell and narrated by an all-star cast, Robert Redford, Ashley Judge, Van Jones, Isabel Allende, and Meryl Streep. And my great thanks to Lois Gibbs, who's one of the heroes of the film, became an activist because of the situation in Love Canal and has now made it her life's work, and Mark Weiss, who's the executive producer of the film, which opens tomorrow at the Cinema Village on 22 East 12th Street. At least it opens here. It's opening nationwide tomorrow, isn't it?
It's opening nationwide. It's rolling out over the next month and a half and probably be in about 25 cities currently, and that's expanding.
Well, thank you both so much for being on our show.
Thank you. It's a real honor to be here. Thanks for having us on.
Thanks so much.
The Natural Resources Defense Council was founded in 1970, the same year as the Earth Day was created. Frances Beinecke began working at the NRDC as an intern 3 years later, and since 2006, she's been president of the council. She says that after 40 years of advocacy for environmental causes, she remains optimistic, even while scientists raise serious concerns about climate change, sea level rise, biodiversity loss, and other problems, while polls find that the public doesn't place environmental issues among the top threats facing our country. Frances Beinecke writes about her personal experiences, current developments, and her reasons for optimism in her new book called The World We Create, A Message of Hope for a Planet in Peril. It's from Roman and Littlefield, and I'm very pleased that it brings Frances Beinecke back to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
When you joined the NRDC 40 years ago, which environmental issues seemed most pressing then?
Well, when I joined NRDC, we were looking at land use, clean air, clean water. Shortly after I got there, there was proposals to drill offshore in the Atlantic, and that became a very important issue to me. Interestingly, 40-plus years later, they're proposing that again. So the issues
And we've
were,
had BP in between.
Yes, and I was on the President's Oil Spill Commission and got a very close personal look at the consequences of that spill and how enormous they were across the whole Gulf of Mexico, five states. Really suffered, and you know, many people in their daily lives, their livelihoods were really put at risk from one rig gone bad. I mean, it was really consequential, just huge.
Several environmental groups were launched around the time the NRDC was created. Was that part of the activism of the time, or were environmental fears moving people independently?
I think what happened then, you know, the 70s, you will remember, was a very active time of social engagement around a whole host of issues. The environment was certainly one of them. We had had a big industrial boom after World War II, and there were lots of pollution issues that people were experiencing every day, and we weren't taking care of them. So there was a real outpouring across the country to take action on the environment. And that's where the movement was really born.
And Richard Nixon was the president at the time. Was
he
engaged in some of this?
So actually, President Nixon
went out. He created the EPA, didn't he?
He did create the EPA. When the Santa Barbara oil spill happened, he went out, flew over it. He was from California. And he looked at that and he said, we cannot treat our environment this way. So all the major environmental legislation, clean air and clean water, was passed on his watch, which is kind of ironic for a child of the 70s, where we were calling for Nixon's resignation and other things like that. But in this area, he had real impact.
Ironic also in the fact that most of the members of his party running for office now want to get rid of all the things that he enacted into law.
You know, that is so true. And one candidate after another on the Republican side, led by Senator McConnell, calls for doing away with EPA, doing away with regulation. But if you look at the polling across the country, every person, in my view, in America expects their water to be clean, expects their air to be clean, and expects companies to be held accountable. And so, that's what we do.
Well, but the polls also indicate that the environment is not a top priority. Immigration, Ebola, terrorism, a whole bunch of other things are considered more important by the public. And also people, candidates are running on campaigns that say, I'm going to get rid of the EPA.
There are candidates running on that, but there
are going to win.
More candidates running for a clean and healthy environment. And there are climate deniers. There's no question about it. That group has a loud voice, but it's actually narrow. And our polling shows increasingly people, majority of Americans, certainly majority of Democrats, majority of independents, and even majority of Republicans expect us to protect our environment and take action on climate change.
News reports from the early 1970s include coverage of nuclear power, ozone, air quality, protecting public lands and specific species. Was climate change or global warming even on the radar at that time?
It really wasn't on the radar. You know, the first thing that I remember was Gus Speth, one of NRDC's founders, he was at the Council on Environmental Quality in 1980, came out with a report on climate change. But actually, I saw an early piece of research by Rachel Carson, some of her field research in the 50s on coastal tidal areas in Maine. In the top right-hand corner of her index card, in pencil, she wrote climate change. That was 1954. So I think the science community was aware. The broader environmental community wasn't aware. But since the 90s, this issue has become larger and more urgent. And just yesterday, the UN came out again with its latest report on climate change, where it talks about pervasive, irreversible effects and the need to take action on climate now. And I think the science case is so strong, it's our obligation to really build the political support for action here in the United States.
And yet there are people in Congress like James Imhoff who call this all a big fraud.
Well, you know, he may.
And then others who say, I'm not a scientist, so I can't talk about that.
You know, that seems to be the Republicans' mantra right now. But the fact is, the science is very, very strong. And the case across states, across America, from sea level rise to drought to extreme storm events, what's happening is people are witnessing climate change in their communities, at their homes, now, and wanting to know, how are we going to be protected from this?
Although, is it South Carolina, North Carolina, that has enacted a law that says you can't even talk about climate change?
North Carolina enacted that law, and they've been Moral Mondays in North Carolina week after week after week, where the public has turned out to demand change in the North Carolina legislature for a whole host of social issues.
Well, that's the effects of sea level rise, I
guess,
was what they said you couldn't in research. A 1972 book, The Limits to Growth, raised alarms over population, which was then 3.7 billion. Now the world has nearly twice that, 7.2 billion. Has population diminished as a concern?
No, I don't think it has. I think the reality is, you know, we as a human race use our resources in a very depleting way. And, you know, as the population grows, first of all, you know, we need to provide health care and economic opportunity across the world. It's really important. And manage our resources sustainably. And bringing those issues into alignment is one of the great challenges, you know, of both the environmental movement, but, you know, much broader than that.
My guest is Francis Beinecke, president of the Natural Resources Defense Council, the nation's foremost environmental advocacy group. She's written, with the help of the NRDC's editorial content director, Bob Deans, a book called The World We Create, A Message of Hope for a Planet in Peril. It's published by Roman and Littlefield. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Every so often, nuclear power is brought back onto the table because we are seeing growing demand for electricity. Despite the Fukushima disaster, hasn't interested in finding new ways of developing nuclear reactors and plant designs been growing?
It really hasn't been growing. There's always research going on, but our nuclear, the part of our energy sector from nuclear, which is about 20%, has stayed stable for about 30-plus years. There's one nuclear plant coming online in the South. Southern Company is having one coming online. Within the next several years, the cost overruns have been considerable. The thing about nuclear energy, there are several issues that continue to plague it. One is the cost of it. It is much more expensive than any other source of energy. And now both renewables and natural gas and others are cheaper. But also the issue of nuclear waste from these power plants.
Where do you put the spent fuel?
Right now, it stays. The fuel rods stay at the location of the power plant. We don't have a nuclear waste repository. There have been many efforts to put one in place. Yucca Mountain, New Mexico, hasn't happened. So until you solve the waste issue and the proliferation issue, this is still a nuclear fuel that can be turned into weapons. That's a very serious issue across the world. That has to be contained. So from NRDC's standpoint, the cost issues, the waste issues, the proliferation issues, security issues still dominate. They haven't been successfully addressed. And, you know, at this point, nuclear is not competitive with other things.
Much of this book that we've been talking about revolves around fossil fuels. Is that the most pressing global issue at the moment?
Well, fossil fuels are what is creating climate change. So there are two things happening. One is climate change is a very serious threat globally. It's a human rights issue. There are people all over the world who will not be able to cope with this. So we really need to address climate change. Also, people all across America have suddenly, with our oil and gas boom going on, they are on the front lines of energy development. There's fracking in people's front yards and next to their schools. There are oil trains going through communities, major cities all across America, incredibly volatile, explosive oil that are putting communities at risk. People along the Gulf Coast who suffered from the impact of the oil spill, you know, that was had a huge impact on them and with long-term consequences to the health and well-being of the Gulf of Mexico. So we need to get off our fossil fuel addiction and move to clean sources of energy and become carbon neutral.
Do you object to fracking just in principle or in the way that it's being done?
The way fracking is being done now is really putting communities at risk. It is not adequately regulated at the state or federal level. It's causing serious water and air pollution problems. And it is fundamentally changing communities where the oil industry basically controls what happens in those communities, and the community has very little voice. So we at NRDC are really focused on putting in safeguards, ensuring areas like New York City's watershed that should be off limits because they serve a greater purpose are protected, and that these communities have a voice and have legal representation when they need it.
Could fracking be done in a way that is less harmful to the environment?
I think that's to be determined. I think right now fracking is going on in over 30 states. The states have very different forms of regulation, very different forms of transparency. Tremendous amount of work has to be done, both in the research on what the impacts of fracking are on the quality of water and whether we can put in adequate safeguards. And from a climate standpoint, natural gas emits tremendous amounts of methane, which are a climate damaging chemicals, and those have to be contained because there's no benefit if they're creating the same greenhouse gas emissions as carbon.
And a third concern is that we've seen earthquakes in some of these areas.
Yes, that is indeed true, both in the United States and in Europe. They've seen earthquakes happen out of the fracking that's actually going on, which has really alarmed people in places where they've never had earthquakes.
The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has just released the last part of its assessment of what's happening to the climate. Have you seen it?
Yes, I read the summary yesterday, the IPCC report.
In a New York Times essay, Andrew Revkin criticized the IPCC report for missing what he calls inconsequential energy research in advanced democracies. Do you agree?
I didn't see Andrew's blog on that or his article on that, but I think there is a lot of research going on in new energy. I think our big challenge is unleashing it and really accelerating the change to clean energy as quickly as possible.
In this book, you mentioned President Obama's Clean Power Plan, which he rolled out last June. What does that aim to do?
The Clean Power Plan aims to control emissions from our largest single source, which are existing coal and gas-fired power plants. It's a regulation under the Clean Air Act. It is what the president can do using his existing authority because it's impossible to get legislation through the United States Congress now. The Clean Air Act is a very powerful tool. Their ability to use the Clean Air Act to regulate carbon has been upheld multiple times by the Supreme Court. And we think this is a very promising opportunity for the states to develop their own energy plans for the future that focus on efficiency and renewables and reduce their emissions and put the U.S. actually in a leadership position in the world for controlling carbon.
Has there been a recurring problem of governments announcing ambitious goals that don't carry any real force? So it sounds good, but they don't get it met?
Well, I think that's where the obligation of the public comes in, being vigilant and making sure that we do meet what the opportunity is. So the Clean Power Plan would reduce our emissions by 25% from the power sector. We think that number could be a lot higher based on NRDC's analysis. So in our role, we are going to advocate for the strongest reductions we can possibly get. And in doing so, that should put the U.S. in a leadership position going into international negotiations in 2015, where there'll be another effort at reaching a global agreement on climate change.
In the 70s, there were a lot of people concerned. Did you see a swing at some point, perhaps in the Reagan years, or has there been a steady change?
I think what's happened, so in the 70s, there was a lot of outpouring and activism, and then a lot of laws were passed, and the environmental community grew and took care of a lot of environmental issues. One thing I think is really heartening and exciting right now is there is another wave of citizen engagement around the environment. In September, right before the UN Climate Summit, there was a march in New York City, the Climate March, the People's Climate March. 400,000 people turned out at that march, three times the number that was expected. And I think that's just a look at how strong the feeling is and that it's growing across the country for climate action.
On the other hand, midterm elections are underway today. How optimistic are you about how those are going to turn out?
Well,
does the NRDC run ads in support of specific candidates?
But we have an NRDC Action Fund, which is the political arm of NRDC, which has been supporting a number of Senate candidates who are up. Who knows what the outcome will be? Certainly the margin, whether it goes to the Democrats or goes to the Republicans, is going to be very, very narrow. And I don't think it's going to change that much, the fact that not much is happening in Congress, which is exactly why we're looking to the president's leadership on the Climate Action Plan for action on power plants.
So you're giving up on Congress to some degree?
For the moment, I think that it will take some time to kind of regain a Congress that's willing to take positive action on the environment. I mean, in the House side, in the last year, there have been over 400 anti-environment votes. That's just where the Congress is. Based on our polling, we do not think that represents where the American public is. And I think one thing that's happening through, as I mentioned, the kind of experience with fracking and energy development that's going on all over the country, there are voices being raised about where people expect environmental protection to be in the United States.
But the Democrats had a supermajority in 2009. Why wasn't there any cap-and-trade bill?
You know, I think
then?
What happened, the cap-and-trade bill—
Or any other environmental legislation, for
that
matter.
Well, it passed in the House, but 2008, as you recall, was a serious economic downturn, and the economy dominated all attention at the political level. And, you know, we weren't able to get the legislation passed, but we've learned a lot. We're building a base of support. The environmental community is growing stronger every day. And, you know, so it takes time to get legislation. We hired somebody at that time who'd said to me, Francis, you know, no major legislation passes on one effort. It takes, you know, multiple efforts. We're prepared to take as long, you know, not as long as it takes because we don't have time for that, but to put in every ounce of muscle we have to get political support to get action on climate change.
Is cap and trade the best way forward, carbon tax?
I think, those are two different things. And, you know, we think a plan that reduces emissions, whether it is cap and trade, whether it's a price on carbon from a carbon tax, the design matters. But in the end, It has to reduce emissions at the least cost because that's what's going to win. So the structure of it, since we're, I think, several years away of actually getting legislation on climate, there are lots of different approaches on the table, and we'll evaluate every one. But in the end, it's about emission reduction. So that's the way we're going to judge it.
My guest is Frances Beinecke. Her latest book, The World We Create, A Message of Hope for a Planet in Peril, published by Roman and Littlefield. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Frances Beinecke, B-E-I-N-E-C-K-E, in case you didn't know. She's written, with the help of Bob Deans, The World We Create, A Message of Hope for a Planet in Peril. It is published by Roman and Littlefield. Can there be overemphasis on news like biodiversity loss or sea level rise? In your own experience, have you seen people filter out the news if too much of it seems negative?
So I think there is a real risk at doom and gloom, and that's why we're really focused on what are the solutions to these issues.
Why you put the word hope into your subtitle?
Yes, absolutely why. I am an optimist. I do have hope. And actually, over the length of my career, 4 decades, I have seen real progress on various issues. And, you know, we as a community, as an organization, are just vigilant over the long term and putting the solutions in place step by step that we think are essential. So, you know, telling the story of what's happening in biodiversity, what's happening in climate change, that's very important, but it's equally important to show the path to addressing it.
And you're not alone. Diane Ackerman was here in September to discuss her book, The Human Age, which has a subtitle, The World Shaped by Us. That's kind of similar to your title. Mm-hmm. Do you think it's a coincidence that two women activists are emphasizing that people do have a measure of control over environmental outcomes?
Well, I think so that's interesting. I think women do have a long-term view, and I think generally are hopeful. Over the course of my career, really looking at what's happened in the last 5 years, even with the solutions that we know will work, we know that we can't achieve them without a much stronger voice and engaging people. So really understanding, how do people connect on these issues? What will make them want to participate because the outcome will benefit them, will be something that they'll be able to experience, is a really important part of the work that we do.
A number of prominent scientists and others have made very pessimistic statements regarding our chances in the face of the environmental problems. Stephen Hawking actually believes that our species faces extinction.
Well, that isn't my view. I think eventually maybe that is true if you look in the entire eons of time. But I think we have a responsibility to now. So we're very focused on what are the threats of now and how do we address them.
And have some environmental problems emerged that people didn't even imagine 40 years ago?
Well, I think ocean acidification, which is a direct outcome of climate change, changing the chemistry of the ocean.
What about the open ocean at the North Pole, for example?
Yes, well, the changes in the Arctic and the changes in the Antarctic, the fact that the Arctic and the poles are changing more rapidly than any other part of the world is something we wouldn't have projected. I think that one of the things that happened on climate change in the 90s, when we first started addressing the issue, we were looking at models, and now we're looking at fact. And we were thinking in future generations, and now we realize that the projections are wrong and we're thinking about now. So our actions that we're proposing are for now, how to get us on a low carbon pathway to a carbon neutral pathway as quickly as possible so that the natural systems of the world will still function to benefit the human race.
Environmental health scientist John Wargo made the point on this show that human activity has altered the chemistry of the Earth's biosphere. Some people are concerned that we've passed a tipping point.
Well,
and we've seen right now species going extinct faster than in any time in the past 100 million years.
Well, I think the changes are happening very rapidly. People are talking about the Anthropocene, which is really the human race is causing the changes on the planet. And I think that's true. So it's really our responsibility, our moral obligation to try to assuage those as quickly as possible and minimize what the impacts are. There's no question that there are serious long-term impacts through extinction, through changes in chemistry. We have to do everything in our power to change that. Not that we're going to get rid of those threats or, solve the problems completely, but we can't ignore them, and we should do everything that we can. And I am optimistic. You know, if you look at, for example, renewable energy is the fastest growing energy sector in the country.
Do you think windmills will take the place of fossil fuels?
I think they very well could. Go to Europe. They have, in a very considerable way, solar in Germany, wind in Denmark and Spain. You know, this is a winning technology that is increasingly affordable and where people are making money from it too. So one of the things is we have a system that is built around fossil fuels where the subsidies have been heading in that direction for 100 years. We have to change that and unleash the opportunity of clean energy, do the research on new technologies so that we can become carbon neutral.
What are some of the non-climate, non-energy-related issues that the NRDC is working on? I know you issued a report in April on chemicals in our food, focusing on a legal exemption known as generally recognized as safe. Does that have environmental implications?
Yeah, well, one of the things that's a very serious concern in this country is that we are a chemical-based society. There are 80,000 chemicals out in the, in our general environment. And we have a law, the Toxic Substances Control Act, which was passed in the 70s, which is woefully inadequate. So we have been working with colleagues in a coalition. And actually, there's some interest. This is an area where there is some interest in Congress to reform and amend that law. Right now, very few of the chemicals get adequate treatment, and it's really up to EPA to do the testing, not up to the company to prove the chemical is safe. So, you know, we have a cancer epidemic in this country. I personally am a cancer survivor. Just in every family there, people who are experiencing cancer of one kind or another. We live in a toxic society, and we have to try to get control of that. There's a lot of work being done on green chemistry, looking at alternative products that would be used in the workplace, but that has to be accelerated. And that's another example. If you look at the fossil fuel industry owns the energy space, the chemical industry owns their space. They're an incredibly powerful interest group, and trying to bring to bear changes in the way our chemicals are tested and made available in the broader environment is something that is going to require tremendous outpouring of citizen demand. And that's where the consumer sector comes in very powerfully, because companies aren't going to sell products if consumers don't buy them.
You mentioned cancer in the first segment of our show today. Sharon Lerner talked about a cancer cluster in Florida. And it's led to a major split in the community because some parents, mostly women, are concerned about its impact on their children, some of whom have developed brain cancer, mm-hmm. while others, mostly men, are concerned about property values. And if there's a successful suit against the accused pollutants, then their property values will go down. They won't be able to sell their homes.
Well, I think that's, an indicative problem around the country. Understanding where the sources of chemicals are and controlling them and ensuring that the government agencies that have the responsibility actually have the wherewithal, the resources to provide the kind of oversight and accountability that's really required. This is one of the problems, in my view, of the voices that call for diminished government. Government has a responsibility to protect people. And if they're not adequately resourced to do that, they can't do their job. And there are communities that are disproportionately impacted all over the country from the petrochemical industry, other industries, and they deserve to have the kind of protection that others have had in the past.
Doesn't the EU take a different approach to chemicals? They require that they're shown to be safe, that they're shown to be harmful.
That's exactly right. The EU has much stronger laws on toxics, and that's actually the design, or it's the model that we've been using in the calls for reform around the toxic chemical Substance Act, TSCA. You know, that's the difference in the EU is that the government is looking out for how to protect their people. And in our country, you know, the chemical industry just has tremendous weight in the debate. And it's not until consumer voices and join together and call for changes in the products, which is happening, for example, in some of our plastics, where the alarm, particularly from young mothers, is changing the plastics that are being used that their babies and young children are exposed to. You know, one thing is companies, you know, as I say, they're not going to put products on the market that people don't buy. So really educating the public and harnessing those voices to demand change is a really important part of it. It's not enough. And that's why the name of my book, which is The World We Create, I think the we is a really important part of this because, you know, one thing I've learned is we can have all the expertise on the policy side. We could put the pollution, the solutions out there, but if you don't have people demanding that change across society and really create a political force, you're not going to be able to succeed. So really harnessing the individual interest into a united voice demanding action is something that's really at the top of our agenda.
You note that presidents going back to Richard Nixon have urged us to reduce our dependence on foreign oil. From an environmental standpoint, is that a good policy, considering the fact that we're this leads us back
to
fracking
and
drilling?
Very good point, Leonard. So
Alaska,
what we really need to do is reduce our reliance on oil and on fossil fuels, not reduce our reliance on foreign oil. Now, there are some good signs there. For example, in the president's first term, they passed the administration adopted improved fuel efficiency standards. There's a whole lot of different new types of automobiles coming out, hybrids, plug-in electrics, all electric, all more fuel efficient than earlier models. The amount our energy demand is going down. Young people are not getting their licenses as soon as they can. People want to move into cities, have walkable, bikeable communities. So I think actually, you know, the signs are changing. They're going in an improved direction. But it's not that we should get off imported fuel or fossil fuel. We should get off fossil fuel generally and really invest in the alternatives that are going to be better for this country and better for the planet.
There are numerous environmental groups, not just yours, but the Environmental Defense Fund, the Sierra Club, Greenpeace, and sometimes they disagree. Has that created a problem?
Well, actually, all of those that you named, we work quite closely together. Our approaches may be different, but on the issue of climate change, we're united that this is the number one priority that we need to address together. So some of us are policy experts. Others are grassroots engagers. It's going to take our entire community working together to really get the change we seek.
In a post on an NRDC blog, you commented on what you called a tidal wave of special interest money threatening to corrode the very foundation of democracy. But then critics say that environmentalists are a special interest group.
Well, I think we're a public interest group because we basically are representing the public. We have a broad membership. NRDC represents 1.4 million people across the country who are interested in these issues. And we don't benefit economically from the solutions that we're trying to put in place. And I think that's the difference. If you look at what I'm calling special interests there, those are interests that are investing for a particular outcome that basically has an economic benefit to them. An environmental organization that's in the public interest, we're working hard on issues that we're committed to and passionate about. We don't benefit from that. We hope everyone benefits from that.
Economists like William Nordhaus note that we naturally tend to discount the future. If the costs of environmental damage are years away, how do you encourage people to act now?
Well, I think one of the things is we're finding that the costs of climate change are right now. They're not in the future. I mean, you look at the oyster industry off the state of Washington, ocean acidification is changing that today. You look at the Navy installation in Norfolk, Virginia, sea level rise is changing that today. So I don't think we actually have to look to the future. We don't have to put these things in the future context. But one of the challenges—
So why do you think more businesses aren't on your side?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is So increasingly, businesses are putting into their financial planning the risks of climate change and the cost of carbon. The thing that concerns me is they're not willing to engage politically on it, and that's where they need to change. Because if they're putting that into their business plans, why aren't they allowing that to be part of public policy in this country? They should. They should show leadership. Some are, not enough. And, you know, if they're willing to protect themselves by doing that, why aren't they willing to protect the whole country at large?
Frances Beinecke's latest book, written with the help of Bob Deans, is The World We Create, A Message of Hope for a Planet in Peril. It has a foreword by Sigourney Weaver, and it is published by Roman and Littlefield. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
The Gowanus Canal in Brooklyn is one of the rare New York City landmarks that you can usually smell before you see it. And although the fetid Superfund site was once compared to the River Styx, it has played a crucial role in the building of Brooklyn and remains an excellent template for exploring the various waves of boom and bust which have washed over this part of the country. Joseph Alexiou illuminates the people and the history behind one of the most important waterways in New York Harbor with his book, Gowanus, Brooklyn's Curious Canal. It's published by New York University Press, and I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Alexiou to our show today. Hello.
Thank you so much, Leonard, for having me.
How did the Gowanus Canal help build the Brooklyn that we know today?
Well, there are many ways in which I could argue that, but mostly during the Industrial Revolution around, let's say, 1840s, 50s, and 60s, a lot of the materials used in building the houses of the and the businesses, you know, the commercial structures of Brooklyn were carted in, barged in along the Gowanus Canal. We had lumber yards, brick yards, coal yards powering everything. All of the building material, so much of it came through the canal.
And is that why so much industry developed around the canal?
The industry developed around the canal it was sort of a matter of convenience. Already in other parts of Brooklyn, particularly around Red Hook, the Atlantic docks, they found that putting place where boats could dock right next to the warehouses was a great system, and it wasn't the case in Manhattan. So by allowing these lumber yards or, say, coal yards especially to be right next to the canal, you could then build a manufactured gas plant or a wood planing, you know, facility.
You say that the canal's importance has largely been forgotten. Is that because it has become a problem?
Absolutely. The canal used to be an industrial thoroughfare. 26,000 vessels would go up and down it every year. It was considered a huge employer, a place of commerce. And then in addition to that, it became extremely polluted. And everyone knew it was polluted. But once it stopped being a place of commerce, people stopped caring about it.
It's not just industrial pollutants, but also human waste.
That's right.
So sewers were going into it as well?
Well, one of the first sewer systems ever to be built in Brooklyn, in fact, the original Brooklyn City sewer system, was connected to the Gowanus directly, and it basically has been ever since.
Why do you call it Brooklyn's Curious Canal in your subtitle? What's curious about it?
Well, it is curious mainly because I believe the first time that anybody falls upon it, not knowing it's there, even being aware of it, you kind of are filled with wonder, what is this? Because you're surrounded by something that is not normal for New York, which is this, this body of water and around it these warehouses, which you do get in New York, but it's this other world in a way.
There's a bridge over it.
There are this multiple bridges, mm-hmm. actually. I believe there are five
regular
bridges.
Streets.
Yes.
And we have something slightly similar with Newtown Creek, but they have very different histories.
They are different, but their pollution is quite similar in many ways. They have different histories, for sure.
What would the Gowanus area have looked like when Henry Hudson sailed into New York Harbor in 1609?
So the harbor itself, the Bay of New York, was this amazing, lively place full of both flora and fauna. There would be dolphins and whales and porpoises, all kinds of birds, and
lots of oysters.
Oysters galore, fish, eels, octopuses, you name it. And the Gowanus in particular would have looked like a sort of arm of the sea, a kind of inlet of salt water stretched into the land of Brooklyn, surrounded by about a square mile of salt marshes.
But most more like a creek?
It would have been like a big creek. It would have been pretty broad at places, sometimes 20, 30 feet wide.
Who were the first Europeans to settle in the area?
Well, from what we can tell, some of the earliest Europeans in Brooklyn started settling around 1626, and they were either of English, but mostly Dutch extraction, but a large group of Walloons, or the French Huguenots that were escaping religious persecution, and they came out of Utrecht in what is now the Netherlands.
And who gave it the name Gowanus?
Well, nobody knows for sure. There's an early 20th century historian named Martha Bakay Flint who wrote about Brooklyn, and she describes Gowanus as one of the most elusive place names in the history of New York. There's a story, some of which is considered apocryphal, about a Native American chief named Gowane, a sachem of a local group of Lenni Lenape natives. And what's interesting is that while we have plenty of stories about this name, which emerged around 1901, in the actual land patents that we have copies of, the Dutch purchasing the land from local natives, there's nobody named Gowanus. There's a sachem Ka, C-K-A, but that's as close as we get to Gowanus.
The Dutch, when they settled Manhattan, started doing landfills almost immediately. Did they see a similar potential in the Gowanus Canal?
Absolutely.
Well, it wasn't called the canal then.
No.
Gowanus Creek?
They called it the Gowanus Creek, or they would have called it the Gowanus Kill, that being the Dutch word for a creek. And what the Dutch did is what the Dutch often do when it comes to development. They built mills. The Dutch loved to build mills, and they had a lot of experience with dealing with waterways and canals. And so what they did was they actually brought with them African slaves, and we have a lot of sort of proof of this. And they dug the flooded meadows around the creek into what we call mill ponds. And they used those mill ponds to do proto-industry, that is building these grinding mills that using water wheels would grind ginger and corn and grain and even chickpeas.
How long did slavery last in this area?
Well, I hate to say it. I don't know the exact year that New York as a state gave up slavery and made it illegal. I want to say it took place in the 19th century, believe in maybe something like 1827, but don't quote me on that because I'm not sure.
So fairly late, actually.
Late. I mean, it was certainly part of there were, however, free black people also living in New York State at the same time that people owned slaves. Yes, but it was rather late.
My guest is Joseph Alexiou, who is also the author of the sixth edition of Paris for Dummies. That is a very different kind of book from the one we are discussing, which is called Gowanus, Brooklyn's Curious Canal. It is published by NYU Press. It's kind of hard, if you have been to the Gowanus area, to think of it as pastoral these days. Did many people live in Kings County at the outbreak of the Revolutionary War?
There were people. There was a population. It was definitely scattered and not very, people were collected into different villages and towns. And so there wasn't much population density. During the time of the Revolution around 1776, there would have been, dozens of farms and then several villages, one including Gowanus, as well as Brooklyn itself, Bedford, and they would have been agricultural in their livelihood.
The Battle of Brooklyn was one of the most important clashes during the Revolutionary War. Did any of it take place in the Gowanus area?
It took place directly in the Gowanus area. During that time period, Kings County, were divided into different regions, let's say, and anywhere that was sort of near the Gowanus Bay or that Gowanus Creek area, down to the area we call Sunset Park, was referred to as Gowanus. And the largest pitch battle of the Revolution was the Battle of Brooklyn. And the biggest fighting took place essentially in the area that we think of as Park Slope and South Slope. So we're talking of the foothills north of where Greenwood Cemetery is, leading up to approximately where 3rd Street is. Along the Gowanus, there was a massive battle in the middle of a field, a bloody massacre, so to speak.
Who won?
The British definitely won that battle. The Americans retreated in different directions. A lot of them were killed. And there weren't just British, but there were also Hessian mercenaries who contributed to the...
I've always thought it was the Fort Greene area because of the cannon and Fort Greene Park.
Well, that was not all, you know, in, I mean, the truth was the British were very cunning. They split into three different groups, and they had this very simple strategy. The idea was that they were going to flank the Americans, which is to say they were going to surround them on three sides. And it was easy for them to do this because they're in the field of battle were approximately 6,000 Americans, and the British had approximately 20 to even 30,000 troops available to them. So they first came from the south along the shore, along what we call Greenwood Cemetery. Then they came through the pass and the hills known as Battle Pass, which you can jog through now as part of your run in Prospect Park. And then they secretly walked along the Jamaica Road, coming around where we the entrance of the Jackie Robinson Parkway, more or less, in East New York. And they brought their largest contingent of 10,000 men down upon the Americans at the middle of the day of August 27, 1776, approximately near Fifth Avenue and Third Street, where there was a house known as the Old Stone House of Gowanus, a replica of which still exists today. And that is kind of a monument to that battle.
After the war, Brooklyn, which was then a city, went through a population explosion.
That's right.
How fast did it grow through the 19th century? And was Gowanus one of the centers of that growth?
It's interesting. It was one of, I mean, it grew at an exponential rate. So by 1800, I believe the population of Brooklyn was approximately 1,500 to 2,000 people. By 1814, it had doubled. And then by 1834, when it became a city, the population was, I believe, at least 10,000. And it increased at a faster rate than Manhattan grew after that every decade. Now, the Gowanus area was certainly populated, but it was mostly populated by poor individuals, people that lived in a sort of slum existence, a lot of Irish and German immigrants, whereas the areas south of, let's say, the proper Brooklyn Village, sort of where we think of as Brooklyn Heights today, but also Borough Hill, anything south of Atlantic Avenue, that started growing, especially after 1834.
And then later Italian immigrants came into the area.
The Italian... go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, the Italian immigrants, I found, they seemed to arrive around the turn of the century, but also maybe in the late 1880s.
And it remained until fairly recently, the Gowanus area, a low-rent district. Now suddenly it's kind of expensive.
It has become expensive. In fact, I used to live there, but I don't anymore because I was priced out.
Does the canal have any practical purposes these days?
Well, there are people that would argue that it does have a lot of practical purposes. There are some businesses, industrial businesses, that make use of the canal for moving around raw materials or scrap. There are plenty of people that live in the area that argue that it has, you know, recreational uses such as boating. There are even people that fish in the canal, which is an activity that is, questionable, I would say.
But. Well, you see boats docked there,
yes.
But I wonder whether anybody would eat the fish that they might catch.
Strange to say, believe it or not, there are people who have said that they have eaten the fish that they catch in the canal, and that is something that brought in one of the many things that brought in the Environmental Protection Agency into the story.
Because they were concerned about the health. A listener wonders if it's safe to breathe the fumes that come off the canal.
This is a wonderful question because of its both historical implications and its current day, you know, relevance. It isn't unsafe. It's certainly unpleasant. That is to say that it is not you cannot get harmed by breathing in the fumes of raw sewage. No.
But you can smell it still when you're walking over one of the bridges that cross the Gowanus.
It is very possible, especially after a rainstorm.
On Union Street, for example.
There is an outfall near Union Street that absolutely would smell of sewage, especially after a rainfall.
One person you focus on in the 19th century is Colonel Daniel Richards, who mm-hmm. you call a scrappy, enterprising capitalist. What was his background, and what did he do to change South Brooklyn?
Well, Daniel Richards was a kind of a quiet Protestant man. He started as such. He came from a Puritan background, and his family moved through New England to New York State. And he sort of came of age and became an adult right around the time that the Erie Canal opened. In fact, he was living in a small settlement in upstate New York in 1825. The Erie Canal changed the economy completely of the place that he lived. And he had worked in produce and in groceries, and he moved to New York in about 1827. And it seems that he did so because his wife had died, and he probably didn't want to live where he had lived before. And what he did for Brooklyn in particular, what he did for New York, is that he came to this area right around the time that it became a city, and he saw these swamps, particularly the swamps of Red Hook. Red Hook, much like Gowanus, was a collection of islands settled with shanty towns and that had been owned by Dutch landowners. There were a couple of buildings, a few mills. And instead of a swamp, he saw the possibility of an entire neighborhood growing around Red Hook. He saw urban growth development.
And right now, hasn't a new outlet for the Gowanus been made in Red Hook? There was a tunnel built.
Yes.
In fact, it led to a building collapse a few years ago.
That's right. That's right. There is.
That's all in an attempt to clean up the canal?
So what the...
Or flush it out?
The building collapse happened when they were improving upon a flushing canal, or rather a flushing tunnel system that had originally been finished in 1911. And they've been improving, the city and the state have been working together to improve upon that. And yes, that did cause a building collapse.
Is Richards responsible for the shape of the canal as we know it today? As you explained it, he believed incorrectly that tidal flow would be able to clean out the waters of the canal.
So Richards had great success developing Red Hook. In fact, because of his as a real estate developer, he managed to open 35 streets in Red Hook and completely fill it in, change the landscape. Richards Street in Red Hook, named after Daniel Richards. He was the person who pushed for the Gowanus Canal project the most. So he had an engineer put in a design. The design the engineer gave cost $300,000 in 1848 money. And so Richards threw out that idea and came up with his own version of it. And in his own version, he said it doesn't need any kind of cleaning system. The tides will take care of it. The design that Richards gave the City Council of Brooklyn at the time was the one they accepted because of its cost. And
we're still living with it.
And we're still living with it today. It dictated the shape of the canal as we know it.
If he had plans for the Gowanus, you identify Edwin C. Litchfield as the father of the canal.
Yes. So while Daniel Richards conceived of the canal and pushed of its existence and argued for it, he quickly fell out of favor politically with Brooklyn and his constituency, so to speak. And so the project kind of floundered for many years. A lot of private landowners were charged with paying taxes to move forward the canal project, but there was no city group made to make it happen. And so landowners privately tried to build walls. They would collapse. It was only when a very wealthy developer, a wealthy railroad mogul named Litchfield came to Brooklyn and again saw opportunity and decided to develop the Gowanus Canal area.
And he went on a buying spree.
He bought a square mile of land in what we now call Park Slope.
Was there a belief that building a better waterway would improve land values? Waterfront housing?
Well, actually, it's interesting. The canal was conceived to settle several problems because, first of all, there were all these flooded meadows in the area. If you look at an 1867 map of that part of Brooklyn, you can see that parts of the area around the canal have been developed. There are houses everywhere, even high up on the hill near to where what Prospect Park is today. But the canal here was not developed because of the flooding. So the canal itself was meant to be deepened to drain for these fields, for the sewage, and then finally, yes, to build housing, but also commercial buildings for commercial activity.
The area still floods. Is that water dangerous?
The water is flooded and full of sewage. So for some people, yes, it's dangerous to your health, you could argue.
And I would think that Edwin C. Litchfield was a pioneer in the spirit of Brooklyn today, because once again, we're seeing a lot of real estate speculation.
Absolutely. Well, what Litchfield did that was unique was he looked at swampland that other people considered valueless, and he saw potential, and he purchased all of it, some of which from the original Dutch landowners. And he used a lot of his own money to conceive of building lots and a drainage plan to make the canal what it was. And in doing so, he would prepare Brooklyn to become the next great commercial industrial power in America. And without his efforts and without the canal's presence, Brooklyn might not have become one of the third biggest cities in America.
I'm speaking with Joseph Alexiou, A-L-E-X-I-O-U. His book, Gowanus, Brooklyn's Curious Canal, is published by NYU Press. We'll continue our conversation after this. And we are back with Joseph Alexiou, who has written a book called Gowanus, Brooklyn's Curious Canal, published by NYU Press. You, as we mentioned earlier, by the end of the 19th century, the Gowanus neighborhood had become one of the densest industrial quarters in Brooklyn, maybe even in the country. It was also called the Gas House District around that time. Why the Gas House District?
The Gas House District, they also called it the Gas Light District, and that was because the predominant industry in the Gowanus, the thing that arguably made it so important to the city of Brooklyn, was that it was where all of the manufactured gas plants were for that neighborhood and for basically Brooklyn as a whole.
Did that make it dangerous?
It did make it dangerous, but it also made it very important because all of the energy, all of the coal that was being changed into gas for heating and lighting people's homes and streetlights took place there.
You also found some songs about the canal from 1898, including one with this chorus: "When the wind blows east, when the wind blows west, or when it's from the north or south, you never get rest. In summer or in winter, in the spring or in the fall, you breathe the same old odors from the Gowanus Canal."
Yes.
So people have been complaining about the smell for over 100 years.
Oh, more than 100 years, for sure. But this one is put into song.
You write that the Gowanus was seen as a necessary and celebrated nuisance. Celebrated?
It was, you know, for the working class, the Gowanus area meant that you had a job in a factory or you worked for the gas works or you had some kind of wage-paying job. And that meant that you were a useful part of modern society.
When did organized crime begin to move into the area?
Well,
didn't Al Capone grow up around the Gowanus?
Al Capone grew up, actually moved to the Gowanus Canal area the same year that they finished building the Flushing Tunnel in 1911. And he lived on Carroll Street between Nevins and 3rd. And he was a child around there. And later mafiosos have said that he learned all he learned about being a thug from growing up around the Gowanus Canal.
Are there any estimates of how many dead bodies have been thrown into the canal or guns?
Well, there has been a lot of estimations about it, but nobody could know the answer for sure. And one of the things that I talk about in the book is that while we currently associate the canal with the mafia, the Sicilian-Italian mafia, but before then it was well known for an Irish sort of mafia, and even before then just as a place where all kinds of illegal stuff happened. But there are probably dozens of bodies in the canal as we speak.
So it was kind of like the Bowery of Brooklyn.
It was absolutely like the Bowery of Brooklyn in every way you could imagine.
Has dredging ever turned up anything unusual?
I mean, even now you can see the wrecks of boats and barges in the canal. People have dredged up bodies. They've dredged up cases with bodies in them. They've found cars. I mean, anything you could think of that might fall into a waterway in New York, they've found.
So you just dumped anything that you want to get rid of?
They started by dumping, you know, their refuse, and then they started dumping industrial waste and then bodies and then I've seen condoms floating through the canal.
For a time, didn't the neighborhood even support a community of Native Americans who'd come down from Canada? What were they doing in Brooklyn?
That is, yes. I don't want to say exactly how to pronounce it correctly. I believe it's Kawanaga. But some of the Native Americans that are Mohawk, I believe, from upstate New York, lived in a neighborhood called North Gowanus, now called Borum Hill. And they were they lived in that neighborhood, and they were the people that were doing the riveting at the very top of skyscrapers, some of the scariest work. And they were known for the Mohawks and High Steel by Joseph Mitchell, which was this famous profile in The New Yorker.
A key figure in the shaping of New York was Robert Moses. What did he think of the area?
He thought it was a blighted slum, and he wanted to build a bridge there, actually. And in the end, they built an expressway and a tunnel. He saw it as an area ripe for plowing through.
You open your book with the story of Sludgy the Whale, a baby minke whale who swam into the canal in 2007. Why do you think people felt so connected to the death of a whale in the canal? And did, was that significant in the history of the canal?
I think it is. For me, and again at the time, Szilagyi was a very interesting phenomenon because it happened right after this massive storm. It also happened right during the Virginia Tech massacre, which was this very awful tragedy. And there was this news cycle happening that was sort of very grim. And then you had all of a sudden this whale, the result of this storm, baby whale swimming in the Bay of New York. And on top of that, right near the Gowanus, which people sort of knew was polluted in a kind of vague sort of way. And there was something about the irony of that and the way the media was covering it that Szilagyi became this heroine, you know, this micro heroine of Brooklyn. And Brooklyn at the time was the focus of a lot of media attention, not to mention real estate. It just all came together at this as one of those moments.
Would the canal have killed Szilagyi?
It probably would have.
I mean, can much life survive in the Gowanus these days?
There is some life. There are small animals, minnows, plants. There have been crabs sighted there. Occasionally you'll see a heron landing in the canal. But a big life form like a dolphin or a whale could not survive for much time.
Is it true that decades ago barge companies would use the canal's toxic waters to keep their hulls clean because it killed barnacles and shipworms and jellyfish?
I found numerous examples of that story of people using the canal as a way to clean the bottoms or the hulls of their canal. How true it is, I couldn't attest to firsthand, but there's documentation for sure.
Now, Christopher Swain has been a guest on our show. He's taken two swims in the Gowanus Canal in a protective suit. Because he wanted to raise awareness about the waterway and the cleanup efforts. Would it be possible to swim in the Gowanus if you didn't have a protective suit?
It'd be possible. I would not recommend it. I would not recommend following Christopher Swain's example either, if we're talking about that.
Well, he's survived it, so...
Because
he knew what he was doing.
Did he?
Oh, okay. Well, we'll have to check into that. In 2010, the area was designated a Superfund site. How long is it projected to last?
The original projection from the beginning of the naming of the site in 2010 was approximately 10 to 15 years. I would say, and there's no way of knowing for sure, but that we're probably looking at around another decade of cleanup.
And it was reported this week that the EPA is considering delaying the cleanup of the canal for a year. Why?
That it wasn't the EPA. I believe it's the city of New York that's looking to delay the cleanup, not the EPA.
There's some kind of a fight between the city and the EPA?
I wouldn't call it a fight exactly. They are currently trying to make plans about where to put a certain retention basin, they call it, which is meant to capture approximately 8 million gallons of raw sewage that would normally flow into the canal.
So raw sewage is still flowing into the canal?
Yes, every day right now. Especially when it rains, approximately 300 million gallons a year.
Have any – well, the city is responsible for that. But what about the other dumping? Have any companies been held accountable for dumping stuff into the canal?
In the past, companies have been held accountable. And the current situation, the Superfund, which is run by the EPA, they are the ones that are finding and identifying and holding responsible the companies that indeed did pollute the canal or historically are known to have polluted the canal.
And has anyone been held accountable?
Yes. They're currently being held accountable by being involved in the cleanup process, which is taking place. Some of these, what they call potentially responsible parties of the EPA, include the U.S. Navy, National Grid is a big one, and then there is, of course, the City of New York.
Now, there every so often environmentalists go down the canal and they test the water. What are the things that they're finding in the toxic soup?
So there's two.
I mean, other than what we've just been discussing.
Well, there are two kinds of, you could say, pollution in the canal. There's the pollution from raw sewage and there's the pollution from toxic waste. In the water, they're likely to find and have found in the past all kinds of pathogens. So E. coli and Enterococcus and cholera, typhoid, typhus. Gonococcus, which is the bacteria that causes gonorrhea, which spawned a whole TV show, the title of a TV show for an HBO series called Bored to Death. And then you've also got toxic materials in the canal, mostly coal tar, which is a byproduct of manufactured gas. and that results in polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, lead, mercury, and then something called NAPL, a non-aqueous phase liquid.
Now, there's a waste plant in Greenpoint, so we have technology to clean up these kinds of things. What's taking so long? What's the problem with the Gowanus?
The problem with the Gowanus is that these sewers in place are the original sewers that were constructed starting in the 1840s and 50s, and that system has never been totally revamped. In fact, that system is what we call a combined sewer system, which means that the rainwater from the street and the sewage water from your toilet or your sink ultimately go first to the same pipe and then get shunted to a sewage treatment plant. However, during periods of heavy rain, because there isn't room in the pipes, it overflows into the canal instead.
So it needs a major infrastructure upgrade?
It needs a huge infrastructure upgrade, which is not likely to happen.
There are luxury condos rising along the banks of the Gowanus Canal. Are people who move there in any danger?
I wouldn't say – well, it depends on what you mean by danger. Are they in danger of having raw sewage flood into their homes? Potentially, yes.
And then there's just the smell.
And there's the smell. And also there's approximately 10 feet on average of toxic waste sitting at the bottom of the canal. And that's approximately, again, 10 feet thick along 1.8 miles of canal, which is approximately 100 feet wide.
So what's the appeal? It's just that real estate prices have gone up so high throughout Brooklyn that any place winds up having some appeal?
At some point in the crowded real estate market that is in New York, any tiny corner can become valuable to someone and used to create something tall and big. And we've been doing this since the Flatiron Building and probably before.
Now, Brooklyn for a long time was considered a last resort for housing. It's a place where immigrants came, and now I guess it's mostly Queens where immigrants come. But Brooklyn's become incredibly expensive, even along the Gowanus Canal.
Especially along the Gowanus.
And why do you think that is?
It's, you know, I have to say the biggest theme for me has to do with speculation. See, I believe that New York is full of people who want to take benefit from its real estate, and that is fine. It's part of the appeal of being here is that every square inch is meaningful to people for some reason. Otherwise, it wouldn't cost so much. And what we're looking at is the potential of moving the kind of zoning that is in Gowanus, that is to say a manufacturing zoning, to a more residential or mixed zoning. And if they change the zoning of many of these industrial buildings that exist still in Gowanus from manufacturing to residential, the value of those properties will go up 10 times, 20 times the amount they are now because residential is worth so much more. And so all these developers sitting around waiting perhaps have already bought the spaces just hoping that the zoning will change.
And now there are people, there are clubs in the area, there are performance spaces, so people want to live near them.
People want to live near them.
And it's close enough to Park Slope on the one hand, and also Carroll Gardens and Cobble Hill on the other.
The location is incredibly convenient, and there's many things to do in the neighborhood now.
And on top of it all, it's a Superfund site.
There's this sort of thing that some people in New York appreciate the grit is the way you can spin that.
Is there a hope that moving people there will speed up the cleanup?
That was the original plan of New York City. In fact, that was always their intention, was to get a whole bunch of people to move there first, and then that would spur a cleanup. That is sort of the logic that a lot of people use to speed it up. But the truth is that the speed up of any cleanup there has nothing now to do with the population. It has to do with the Superfund.
Is it in better shape than Newtown Creek?
Not yet. No, Newtown Creek is not in better shape. And the Superfund at Gowanus is farther along in its process than that of Newtown Creek. They are still got many steps to do before they get to where we are,
And that's probably because Gowanus is located in an area of Brooklyn that more people want to live in.
It's much denser around the Gowanus. Even though it's a much smaller area than Newtown Creek, the population density is just enormous. There's within the 3-mile radius of the canal, which is also the watershed of the canal, there are about 100,000 people.
Did you feel at all hopeful when you talked to city officials in preparing this book?
New York City officials. Do they give me hope? Not really.
Well, Bill de Blasio lived not all that far
Of all the city officials, Bill de Blasio gives me the least hope.
That's another show. Joseph Alexiou, his book, Gowanus, Brooklyn's Curious Canal, is published by NYU Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.